Tonight we're going to conclude our series on Halachic Mythbusters, and I'd like to begin with a sort of a concluding point before we begin tonight's Mythbusters. And the reason I want to do so is because clearly this topic has been one which has been intriguing to individuals. I thank you, first of all, for your attendance, for your feedback, for your suggestions. My apologies to those who may have suggested myths that didn't make it, at least not to this round, but I definitely, have really been, most pleasantly surprised by the sort of reception that this this topic has had. And in thinking about not necessarily why that is so, but just about the effects of that, and this is perhaps will be reminiscent of something that I mentioned in the first year. You know, when I first started putting this together, and it was at the point where I couldn't pull back anymore because I committed, I was a little concerned that if we present myth after myth after myth, there shouldn't be an unintended accumulative effect, and that is that we should walk out of here thinking, everything is just made up. You know, we don't know why we're doing anything anyway. Everything is just one big myth. And thankfully, as time has gone on, week after week, I don't feel that that's the message that's been heard at all. And to the contrary, I know that for myself personally, I think for many of us, it's been quite enlightening. I'm sure that everybody here has walked away with at least one thing that you didn't know beforehand, which will help improve, enhance either your observance of a particular mitzvah or understanding about why we do a mitzvah. So certainly there have been, I'm sure, positive effects in that respect as well. But I do want to once again sort of reiterate that point that I made in the beginning, and I want to do so by way of just sharing a nice thought with you, which is not on the slide. There is a Mishnah in the sixth parak of Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah, it's a famous Mishnah, it's a rather lengthy one, talks about the 48 Dvarim Shehatara Niknes Behen. It's a fascinating Mishnah, and I suggest that you take the time to study it at some point. Several years ago, I tried to do one per night. It didn't work out exactly that way, but in between Pesach and Shavuos, in between Mincha Maariv, we were able to spend 6 or 7 weeks just on this one Mishnah. How Chazal point out that there are 48 different characteristics that a person must try to develop in order to fully and properly and comprehensively be Kone Torah. One of them, it says, V'lo Megis Libo B'Talmudo. Now, the word Megis is the most difficult word to translate there. V'lo means you don't, Libo, his heart, B'Talmudo, when he's learning. So what does Megis mean? So it would seem, B'Derech HaPshat, most would assume that Megis comes from the word Gas, which tends to be associated with some haughtiness, arrogance, that you shouldn't be arrogant when it comes to learning. And this, in fact, is how most would explain the Pashup Shot of this particular Mishnah. However, the commentary, the Teferis Yisrael, suggests that that can't be, because that's too obvious. Chazal don't have to tell us that you can't be a Balgaiva, especially when it comes to learning, if you want to grow in learning. We know that, in fact, that's an impediment. This is not a mila. This is not something that a person should strive for in order to be able to properly connect to Torah. So he suggests something a little differently. And he says this expression of Megis Libo B'Talmudo is associated with another expression that Chazal have. Chazal speak about people who are very close acquaintances. Actually, Chazal speak about a husband and wife, using an expression, somebody Shalibo Gasba, which means that there's a certain closeness, a certain bond that they have, and as a result, I'm not necessarily ashamed to say what's on my mind. And I'll go ahead and I'll speak about a matter of great importance in somewhat of a flippant way. And I'll say something that perhaps does not reflect the sort of inhibitions, the sort of measured thought that I would give when I'm speaking to someone who I'm less familiar with. And he says that what Chazal is saying over here is that if a person wants to truly be Kone Torah, he can't have that attitude when it comes to Torah. The kind of thing, oh yeah. And he actually goes as far as to say that people should have boshes panim when it comes to Torah. And it shouldn't be that any thought that comes to my mind, oh, it could be this, it could be that. And a lot of what we've discussed over here are the sort of things where, perhaps again, and maybe it was an unintended consequence, but, this comes from this place and this comes from that place. But it must be stressed that really for me, and maybe perhaps this message was really felt on my end, perhaps more than yours, and that is because in my research for these topics, I've had a chance to discover and rediscover it again and again and again, not just how many things we do, but how rich the tradition, the reasons, the basis for why is that we do. And the fact of the matter is that these myths, for the most part, are very unusual exceptions, because for the most part, we have a very, very strong and rich Masorah, which is so rich with tradition and reason. Just a couple weeks ago, when I didn't actually do this, but I was still going to talk about the way to make a l'chaim. I don't mean a l'chaim for an engagement. A l'chaim, you know, like chaim, you know, a person makes a little chaim on schnapps. I came across a beautiful shiur written up with, I think it was 5 or 6 pages, extensive discussion about the right way and the wrong way to make a l'chaim. It's amazing. Amazing. Even something as you'll forgive me, as insignificant, maybe something as silly, as trivial, as making l'chaim is a subject of such great, extensive thought and discussion. And really, you know, even though that was not the theme of this series, I hope that we can all walk away with an appreciation before we start tonight that we you know, Ashrenu Matov Chalkeinu. We are so fortunate to be part of a tradition which is so rich and so broad and so comprehensive. And everything that we do and everything that we don't do, everything from the most important and most well-known and prominent mitzvot in the Torah to the most seemingly insignificant minhagim, have such a rich basis and foundation for them. And this should be, this more than anything else, this should be a chizuk and encourage us to continue not just to study Torah, but to strengthen our commitment. So tonight, for the final presentation on the Mishpatim, we're going to talk about things of the past, Jewish history myths. For the most part, the myths that we're going to talk tonight are really biblical myths. We're going to touch upon a few that are not. I didn't know even a week ago where I was going with this. There's so many different possible myths. I try to pick on things that most people wouldn't know, although I'm sure that everybody here knows at least one of the things we're going to talk about tonight. But here are some of the great Jewish history myths. The first one is the fruit of the Eitz Hadas was an apple. Now, I'm sure that most people probably know that it was not an apple. But I'd like to share with you some of the fascinating history behind this myth. So, of course, from time immemorial, everybody knows and people believe and say that, yeah, that famous sin that was committed in Gan Eden, Adam and Chava, when they went ahead and they ate from the Eitz Hadas Tovara, so that was an apple, right? So there are actually two separate discussions which we find in Chazal identifying what exactly was the fruit of the Eitz Hadas. The Gemara in Sanhedrin of Ayin tells us in the name of Rabbi Meir, Oso Ilan She'achal Adam Arishon Mimenu Gefen Haya. The tree wasn't a tree at all. It was a vine, and it was a grape. She'en L'cha Davar She'mevi Yolol Adam El Yayin. Because we know there's nothing that brings about man's downfall more than wine. Rabbi Yehuda says, Chita. He says it was wheat, which is also somewhat strange because it's also not something we think of as a fruit. Because children don't start to talk until they start to eat bread, start to taste food, solids as we call it. Rabbi Nechemiah says, he says it was a fig, because with that very thing by which it was niskalkel, that man's downfall came about, it was fixed. Shenemar, as it says, Vayispru ale te'ena, that after Adam and Chava realized their own nakedness, so they go ahead and they clothe themselves. God provides them with clothing made of a fig branch. And so these are the three opinions found in the Gemara. There's a fourth opinion found in the Medrash, where Abba Da'ako says it was an esrog, because the Pasuk says, Vatera isha kitov ha'etz, that the woman saw that the tree was good, which may mean that she saw it, may mean she tasted, and he says that the only tree that we find where the tree itself has a similar taste to the fruit is the esrog tree. So here you have four opinions. Maybe it was a grape, maybe it was wheat, maybe it was a fig, maybe an esrog, but apple is not one of the choices. Fascinating letter that was written to the New York Times by Lizzie Konovitz in 1907. You know, I'm feeling like somewhat of a scholarly researcher with this thing. I tried to do a little research as to who she was. She was probably just an old, nice, or maybe young, nice woman. 1907, it seems from now she must have been old, but she could have been young at the time. I don't know who she was, but she knew her Chazal. She knew her Chazal. And apparently there was a discussion in the New York Times about this, and they were talking about, was it an apple? So she said, the truth of the matter is, it wasn't an apple. And she quotes the four opinions over here, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Samuel, Rabbi Zera. She quotes all the opinion. And then she quotes very beautifully, and actually this was in the Medrash, but I quote it straight from here, She said that yet the great Rabbi Yehuda exclaimed, why waste time in such discussions? Know you not that the merciful God refrains from naming this tree with the noble intention of preserving the honor of his creations so that it should not be blamed by us as the cause of man's curse? Basically, the Medrash says, Rabbi Yehuda says, you know, maybe there's a reason why the Torah doesn't tell us what kind of fruit it is. So we shouldn't walk by that tree all the time and say, oh, it was all your fault. It wasn't the tree's fault. It was our fault. And so therefore, maybe it's hidden for a reason. But the question is, where does this idea of the apple come from? So Mitch wrote, first, I actually just discovered this today, even though this was published in the Jewish Link not all that long ago. So maybe some of you may have read this. But Mitch just wrote an article on this recently. Mitch, if you don't know, is a member of our shul. Why was the forbidden fruit in Gan Eden an apple? So here are two excerpts from his article. He says, a few explanations for the identification of the fruit as an apple have been suggested. One suggestion is the apple was chosen because of a medieval belief in its romantic or aphrodisiacal qualities. Another suggestion is that the apple was chosen because the words for apple and evil are identical in Latin. The word for both is malum. This is just coincidence, he writes, because the two words have a different origin and are pronounced slightly differently. Adam and Chav is eating when the apple represents original sin, so malum would seem to be an appropriate choice for the fruit involved. He also says many have suggested that the Christian interpretation of the forbidden fruit in an apple was influenced by a story found in Greek mythology. In this story, a golden apple inscribed for the most beautiful one was thrown toward three Greek goddesses. It was purposely thrown to cause a quarrel among the recipient goddess, as Iris knew that they would argue about who was the appropriate recipient. This quarrel set off a chain of events that led to a most tragic war in Greek history, the Trojan War. And many Christians would have known this Greek story. Since the troublesome fruit was an apple there, this may have led to the identification of the troublesome fruit in Gan Eden as an apple as well. Now, in the Sefer Nefesh HaRav, and again, I've quoted this from several times in the series, this is Rav Schechter's Sefer, first of the trilogy on different traditions and insights and perspectives on Rav Soloveitchik. So it says over here that the Rav once said that he followed the minhag of the Gra not to eat grapes on Rosh Hashanah. This is not unheard of. Some people have minhag not to have grapes. And what is the reason? So different reasons that are brought down, but he brings in the reason over here from the Vilna Gaon is because one of the interpretations, as we just saw in the Gemara, as to what the Eitz Hadas Tov HaRav was grape. It was a gefen. And we know Chazal tell us that it was on Rosh Hashanah itself that Adam and Chava sinned, because they were created on Friday and Erev Shabbos, which is the day that we call Rosh Hashanah. And Chazal tells us had they only waited to Shabbos, they would have been able to eat from the Eitz Hadas Tov HaRa, but they had no patience, so they went ahead and they partook of it early. So on this day, on the day, the anniversary of the Aveira, of the Eitz Hadas, so we shouldn't go ahead and eat and partake of the Gefen, which is, according to one opinion, that that fruit. So it says when the Rav was saying this over, somebody said, wait a second, Rebbe, it wasn't a grape, it was an apple. And the Rav responded, that's ridiculous, it definitely was not an apple. There's an opinion that says it was an esrog, this and that. And the Rav said the reason he thinks why people say apple is because esrog is called in Tanakh, in some place called a tapuach. And the Christians got confused when they were translating and they said, oh, tapuach is an apple, but it can't be because apples didn't exist in the Middle East until relatively recently. And he quotes other psukim. When it says Ashir Ashirim, for example, Reyach, Apech, Tapuchim, that's definitely not talking about an apple. It's talking about a citrus fruit, because you could smell it from a distance, as opposed to an apple, which you can't. And that was the Rav said. There's a book, Plants of the Bible, and it says in there, many scholars have argued in favor of the common apple, Malus pumila, but most botanists agree that it is not native to the Holy Land, just as we just saw from the Rav. It was only comparative recently that the poor wild fruits of the common apple have been so improved by selection and cultivation as to bring them to a form which would fit the description in the biblical quotations. So you say, well, what's the nafkamina? What's the difference for us? So here's very interesting. What is the fruit? What fruits do you include in your charosa? So I got this right off the internet. What do you put? What is the recipe for charosa? I'm sure everybody here has their own recipe for charosa. I've heard from Rav Schechter, and you know, it makes sense in light of what we just saw in the Nefesh HaRav, that the Rav Schechter's minhag, I don't know if this was a minhag, how many generations this goes back, but they put citrus fruits, they probably put orange, in the charoses, because the tapuach, again, which we know is part of the charoses, according to one opinion as to why we have charoses, based on the pasuk from Shir HaShirim, that the women, they seduced their husbands to go ahead and have children, but they didn't want to have children, so tachas ha-tapuach. So a tapuach is not an apple tree. They didn't have apple trees in Mitzrayim, so it must have been a citrus tree. With Rav Shechter, if I'm not mistaken, also points that it makes sense because according to another reason is why we have charoses, because it kills the bugs. So the acid in citrus fruits would be perhaps a good form of a pesticide of sorts. Apples wouldn't do it. So the bottom line is, fact is that the fruit of the Eitz Hadas was not an apple. What was it? Different possibilities, but it was not an apple. The next myth, the daughters of Lot committed an abhorrent sin and added further disgrace to their family by the choice of names for their sons. This is somewhat of a provocative one, obviously, because this is one of the more challenging stories in the Torah. The Torah tells us, we'll just summarize very quickly, that after the destruction of Sodom, Lot escapes with his two daughters. His wife doesn't make it, as we know. And they go ahead and they find the cave. And the two daughters realize that, or they think, there's nobody left in the entire world. It's just them and their father. So they conspire. And what happens is one of the daughters, daughters goes ahead and gives her father wine to drink, and he gets drunk. And she sleeps with him that night. And in the morning, at least according to Pashup Shad and Pesukim, Chazal say otherwise, Lot did not realize what had happened. And the next day, the next daughter goes ahead and she does the same thing. And she also lives with her father. And in the morning, she doesn't know what happened. The two daughters of Lot conceive from their father. And they go ahead and name their children Ammon and Moab. The first one names her child Moab, which means May of, from my father. And Ammon, which is Ben Ami, from the son of my people. A little less explicit, a little less direct than Moav, Me'av, that it came from my father. So this is the story. We all know this story, and it's troubling. On the other hand, we could all understand and appreciate there's a lot to debate over here. But I think we would all assume that what they did over here was, pretty abhorrent, and certainly to go ahead and to name their children, Ammon and Moav, so there's no way to justify that. So the Gemara Nazir, Daf Chav Gimel, a fascinating Gemara, says, how do we understand the Pasuk? Ki yasharim darchi Hashem, tzadikim yalchubam, hu pashu yikashlubam. The Pasuk says that the ways of God are yasharim, are proper, and tzadikim walk on these paths, and on these very same paths, the sinners stumble. And the Gemara uses as one of the examples to understand what this very challenging Pasuk means, that Lot and his two daughters serve as an example. Because they had the proper intentions. Hein niskabnu l'shem mitzvah, their intentions were pure, and therefore regarding them, the Pasuk says, v'tzadikim yalchubam. His intentions were impure, and regarding him it says, v'poshim yukashubam. So in other words, the Chazal is saying that two people could do the very same act. For one, it could be considered a mitzvah, and the other one, it could be considered an avera. The Gemara goes on to talk about how we know that Lot was not really acting in that case, l'shem shemayim. So this is an example of what Chazal called an avera l'shma, a very intriguing concept. By the way, don't try this at home. Avera l'shma, wait a second, that really opens the door over here. So basically, anytime I can think of a good reason to do an avera, I can do it. So the Sefer Chassidim says, if a person thinks that he wants to do a mitzvah, he wants to do an avera, which is really for what he believes is a justified reason, he shouldn't do it unless he asks a question. He said, Benos Lot had nobody to ask. They had nobody to ask their questions to, and so therefore they were completely justified on the circumstances of going ahead. It would seem to me that there could be almost no situation which we could imagine today where a person would go ahead and say, I'm going to go ahead and commit an avera l'shma rather than the first ask a shayla. Yes?
Is not a mitzvah for women.
We're not going to get into this from such a technical perspective. There are other psukim which tell us that we have an obligation as members of the human race to go ahead and to see to it that that people populate the earth. Now, why did they name their children Ammon and Moab? After all, there are apps and books where they could give you, look at this, 30,000 names. This is an old one from 2012. I don't know at the time, maybe, actually Noah could have been. Then 2012, this was the number one ranking name. Leon, Mason, Jacob, William, Ethan, Michael, Alexander, James, Daniel. There are other names. So there's another Gemara in Bava Kama, Daf Lamed Ches, which says, Amar B'chi Barabba and Rabbi Yochanan. Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekapeh Schar Ko Beria. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not withhold schar from anyone. And it says what? Afilu schar sicha noa, even the way that you speak. The Ilu B'chira, because the younger daughter of Lot, the Kamra, she said, Moav, she named her son from my father. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMoshe. So later on in the Torah, God says to Moshe, Vayomer Hashem Elai, Al Totzares Moav Yal Tizka BaMilchama. Do not terrorize Moav and do not incite them into battle. Mechamahu Delo, Hangari Avid Buhu. You cannot incite them to war. However, you are permitted to go ahead and subjugate them to a certain degree. However, that was the older one. Bechira is the older one. Tzi'ira, the younger daughter, the Ka'amar, where it says, Ben Ami, she calls her son, Ben Ami, Amar Le'a HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'karav Tamo B'nei Amon, Al Tzureim Yal Tizkar Bam Klau. Over there, the Torah says, don't oppress them, and don't antagonize them, don't incite them at all. Dafilo Angari Lo Tavid Buhu, as if to suggest that there was something more refined about the way that the younger child named her son Amon rather than Moav. But even she, why didn't she name him, Michael? Why did she have to pick such a controversial name? And even over here, the Gemara doesn't seem to really, really throw the book at the older daughter who named her son Moav the way you would expect. So this is what I'm about to show you is a little different than what I've showed you until now. So fasten your seatbelts for this one. This comes from the Hakdamah of the Sefer Igros Moshe, Chelek Ches, one of the more recent volumes to be published. And there's a very nice mini biography of the life of Moshe Feinstein written by his family. And it says over here something which is quite wild. Ramoshe grew up in a place called Luban. And he said, Ramoshe would tell his children that there were many Gedolei Torah there. There were people who were on such a high level that it seemed that they almost had a level of Ruach HaKodesh, and he had incredible stories to share with them. And it says over here that in the beginning of the winter of Tav Resh Pei Beis, it's about 90 years ago, there was one of the balabatim in the shul became very sick. And he had some terrible life-threatening illness. And it was a very strange illness that it seems like his tongue blew up and he couldn't talk properly. It was difficult for him to breathe. And he was getting very close to the end. Ramosha went in to visit him. And he sat with him, and this person went ahead and told Ramosha, sort of like as a dying confession, what he thinks triggered this. And he said that the previous Shabbos was Parshas Vayera, and he was sitting there at the Shabbos table, and he was being, in his words, mevaze benos lot. He's saying it's unbelievable that these women would go ahead and to do such an act, and then go ahead and name their children, right, after, as a way to sort of preserve for all of eternity this act that they did, and from them, Mashiach would come? It doesn't make any sense. V'dibar alein b'derech b'zayon. He didn't speak respectfully. He said that night he had a dream, and two women came and appeared to him in the dream, and their heads were covered, and they said that they were benos lot. They came from the other world. And they wanted to respond to his question. And they said, do you think it was easy for us to do what we did? Do you think it was easy for us to go out and name our children the way we did? We had been rescued miraculously. We were descendants. We related to Avraham Avinu. We could have told the entire world that we conceived miraculously. We could have told the entire world that our children were sons of God, that we were conceived through immaculate conception. But we never wanted the world to think that such a thing should exist. We wanted the world to know that if you ever see a pregnant woman, you know there is a father. That's it. And so therefore we decided at that time that we were going to go ahead and call our children by names that they would always remember and everybody would know that yes, there was a father. Oh, that's correct. There was a father. And so therefore, that's why we did it. And basically they were saying to him, listen, you weren't there. Don't judge us. And apparently he felt that this punishment that he had was a midah keneged midah because he spoke disrespectfully about them. And apparently he turns his head to the wall and passes away. And that's it. This is the story that Moshe Feinstein told to his children. Fascinating story. Bottom line is, the daughters of Lot acted with pure intentions, as Chazal say, and may have named their sons with similar intentions as well. This is not something which is a Maimon Chazal, but a very fascinating idea. Very fascinating, insightful idea as to why it is that they would have named their children the way they did. The next myth. The garment that Yaakov gave to Yosef was multicolored. I tested this on a few people the last few days because I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't the only one out there who actually believed that Ksonas Pasim meant. So I would ask people, what's Ksonas Pasim? And they said, oh, the multicolored cloth. I'm like, good, perfect.
The pasuk says, "V'Yisrael avas Yosef mikol banav ki ben zukinim lo va'asig lo kasonas pasiv." That Yaakov loved Yosef from all of his sons because he was a ben zukunim, which is another discussion, and he gave him kasonas pasiv. What's kasonas pasiv? So we know that's called the amazing Technicolor dream coat. The Gemara in Shabbos tells us a person should never go ahead and favor one child over another, and certainly not express that favoritism because of, says the Gemara, because of Mishkal Shnei Saloi Milah Shenasin Yaakov LeYosef, because of a few dollars that Yaakov spent on this nice article of clothing, more than the other brothers. It caused all this jealousy and it caused them to go down to Mitzrayim. Chazal say it wasn't worth it. So don't go ahead and favor one of your children over another. We can talk about that at much more length at another time, but says the Gemara in Shabbos, it's a halacha, if you will. You shouldn't favor your children in such a way. What does Kasanus Pasim mean? I looked in the article before. It doesn't say anything multicolored in the translations. Rashi says, Pasim is Lashon Kli Milas. This is a reference to a special garment. Kemokar Pasim Techeles. Oh, it quotes a pasuk that we just read yesterday in the Megillah, describing in the very beginning some of the colors which would be found among royalty. Karpas at the Cheles. Karpas is, we know from the Seder, maybe it's like a type of green, indigo color. Cheles, we know. As it also says, later on in Shmuel Beis, Kasonas Pasim, the Tamar Va'amnon. Tamar Va'amnon is also, this is probably, I think, the only reference in Tanakh to this idea of a beged that was associated with royalty. The Medrash tells us, Pasim Shayis Megaset Pas Yado. The Medrash uses, let me turn this one second. Because the pasiyada was the palm of the hand. So the Medrash says it was called Kasonas Pasim because it reached in. In other words, it was long-sleeved. All the other brothers, Nebuch, they had sleeveless. And Yosef, he was chashiv, he got a long sleeve. That's what Kasonas Pasim means. Another possibility also says the Medrash show you said Daka v'kalab Yosef in itnenas pasiyada. It was very small and it could be folded up in the one hand. Why that made it more chashiv, I don't know. Maybe it was just the fact that he got a nice one from his father. Rasad, Reb Sadigon says, Bad sheshesi ve'ervo meshi. It was a silk garment. Chizkuni says Lashon Piyusin Ksonas Noi Kedei Lefaiso. He says Ksonas Pasim doesn't describe the material, the color at all. It really just describes its function, that it was able to, it made people stop and say, wow, that's a nice jacket. And it would enable you to, you know, to get their attention. The Radak says, Pas Echad Mitzeva Zeh, U Pas Echad Mitzeva Shona. Says the Radak, one sleeve at one color, one sleeve at another color. That's multicolored, granted, but you know, you have to go to the Radak to see that. Now, there's a nice, very beautiful sefer on Chumash. It's a nice translation. We have a volume upstairs from Barry Kaplan. We could also talk about him a lot another time. It's called The Living Torah. And this is a great resource. People should know that it exists. We have one upstairs. Some of you have it in your home, and you don't even realize how chashiv it is. You just think it's just another translation. But if you ever, particularly when it comes to sections of the Torah where describing anything having to do with geography or animals or plants or anything which have made, you know, where you may benefit from a person who is familiar with other sources, you know, he provides a lot of rich background and perspective. In addition, his translation is done in a way which is supposed to make it much easier to read than some of the more traditional ones, but he does in a way which is very, you know, very loyal to the text. It's not a commentary; it's really a translation. So he does in a footnote. He says, "Ksonas pasim" in Hebrew is a royal garment. Quotes again, and he says the word "pasim" can be translated as colorful. He quotes the Rabdak, embroidered according to Ibn Ezra, striped with pictures. It could also denote a long garment coming down to the palms of the hands, we saw in the feet. Alternatively, the word denotes material of which the coat was made, like fine wool or silk. Hence, Ksonas Pasim may be translated as a full-sleeved robe or a coat of many colors, a coat reaching to the feet, an ornamented tunic, a silk robe, or a fine woolen cloak. These are all possibilities. So, the fact of the matter is, we'll come to the fact in a moment, but It could be. But Ksonas Pasim certainly doesn't mean necessarily a multicolored coat. There are many, many other possibilities, and it would seem that this notion of being multicolored may be more of the obscure interpretation rather than the more normative one. I did want to digress for a moment to share something really amazing. We're already within 30 days before Pesach, so you can remember this hopefully with Pesach Seder. We know that we saw in Rashi a reference to Karpas. Why do we dip Karpas at the Seder? So the Gemara tells us, Trei Tibuli Lamali, why do we dip twice? We want the children to ask. Says Rashi, we wanted to ask, why are you doing this differently? So it sounds from the Gemara that we just dipped just so people will ask.
In the Rabbeinu Menachem, a peirush on the Rambam, he says the following incredible idea. He says, "Anenogin bekarpas zeche leksonas hapasim she'asel Yaakov Avinu leYosef asher besibasa nisgagel hadava v'yardu avseinu leMitzrayim." Going back to Gemara earlier, he says, "You know why we take the karpas at the beginning of the Seder? Because it's reminiscent of the ksonas pasim." And again, you appreciate it if you look back at Rashi over there, pasim karpas. This is a reminder how it all started. How we end up in Mitzrayim in the first place? Because brothers were fighting. Why the brothers fighting? Over a silly little coat. The ksonas pasim, we start the Seder, and by the way, the symbolism gets even a little deeper if you think about it. Because what do? With the karpas? We dip it. What happened with the ksonas pasim? It was dipped in the blood. And when we eat the karpas, we make a bracha and we say, everybody keep in mind what? What do we say? Keep in mind the morrow later. As if to say, you know, right now it seems, yeah, just brothers fighting. What's the big deal? Later you'll see the big deal. Later there'll be a big deal later. So it's very fascinating. A deep, very interesting insight into a minhag of karpas. Again, the fact is that there's very little evidence to suggest that the garment that Yaakov gave Yosef was multicolored. Myth. Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old when he first spoke to Paro. Now, many of you are probably thinking, well, I didn't know that anyway, so that's not really such a myth. But the reason why this is the best myth that we presented so far, who knows why this is the best myth?
It's the pasuk.
Exactly, because it's a pasuk. The pasuk says, Moshe ben Shmonim Shana, the Aaron ben Shalosh Shmonim Shana, with Abram and Paro.
This is the Etzba.
Oh, we'll get to the Etzba. Oh, very good record. So, the pasuk says that Moshe was 80 years old, and Aaron was 83 years old. So, what a chutzpah. Rothwax is going to tell us it's just a myth? It's a beferish pasuk in the Torah. How could you suggest it's just a myth? So let's draw a very limited timeline of events over here. Moshe's first encounter with Paro, which happens, according to this, at the age of 80. Then they're followed by a period of 10 makos, which lasts, according to the Medrash, 10 months. Some say a year. Approximately 10 months or a year. Then there's Yetzias Mitzrayim. Yetzias Mitzrayim, we know the date, the 15th of Nisan. Now Moshe was born on what day? Zion Adar. Okay? So if we assume that that's so, followed by 40 years in the Midbar, and Moshe's death, so if you plug in all the dates with his years, if he was 80 years old at the time of the first encounter, which means he would have been 81 at the conclusion of the Makos at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, unless you say that the period of the Makos was only 6 weeks, 40 years in the Midbar, he should have been 121 years old when he died, but the Torah says that he was 120 years old. So the numbers just don't work. What's going on over here? If you think I did that a little quick and I'm trying to fool you, look at this later, you'll see. I'm not trying to fool anybody over here. It says he was 80 when the process started. The process took a year. Then they left Mitzrayim. He was 81. 40 years in the Midbar. But yet it says Moshe was 120. So what's going on over here? The Chassam Sofer and Achuva says, regarding the years of Moshe Rabbeinu, it says he was 80 years old when he stood before Paro. He says, but wait a second, Mishpat Mitzrayim, which means the period of the Makos was 12 months, as the Gemara tells us. So it turns out that the Pesach, when he left Mitzrayim, he was 81, because his birthday, as we know, was Zayin Adar. And then 40 years in the Midbar brings him to 121. How could Moshe then say, Ben Meya Ve'esim Shana Anochi Ayom? Later on, there's a pasuk, Moshe says, I'm 120 years old, on the day that he dies. How could this be? So he says, it must be, that when it says that Moshe was 80 years old, it means he was in the 80th year. He was really only 79, but it was in the 80th year. And later on, when Moshe says it was, I'm 120, it means it was actually 120. And he says, with Tzarechian, I don't know. He says, Adayin Tzarechian, I don't love this answer, but what am I going to do? Says the Chassam Sofer. So the fact is, Moshe Rabbeinu may have only been 79 years old when he first spoke to Paro. This is fascinating because the Pasuk again says that he was 80. Myth, when crossing the Yamsuf, Bnei Yisrael emerged on the other side of the sea. Of course, how could this be a myth? We all know the story. Again, look at all the beautiful pictures, and I mean that really. These are beautiful illustrations. It's kedai to look at this and to take it out to, you know, show children and grandchildren as you get close to Pesach. They're amazing. I mean, they're really, you know, they're all obviously imagined illustrations, but there's one thing that they all have in common, and that is that they show a massive group of people walking from one end of the sea to another. Now, the Gemara in Erechin tells us, Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna says, Yisrael Sheba Oso Adar Miktani Amuna Hayim. The Jews, when they left Mitzrayim, that group, were not really such big believers in God. Kedir Rabba Bar Meri, Damar Rabba Meri, Maidachsev, how do we understand the Pasuk, Vayimru Al Yam, Biyamsuf, Vayoshiyem Laman Shemo? It's a Pasuk in Tehillim which says that they complained, they rebelled at the Yamsuf. Malamin Shah Yisrael, Mamrim Bo Sasha.
They were complaining. What were they saying? They were saying just like what? We are what? We're gonna come out the other end. So to the Mitzrayim, we're going to come out the other end. This is what the Gemara says about the people at the time of Yamsuf explaining why the Pasuk in Tehillim says that they complained. So Tosfos over there says, I don't understand. How could it be, I'll paraphrase, but Tosfos, how could it be that they were such Ketani Amuna that they believed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought what? The ten Makos, just to bring them there, to bring them to the Yamsuf, to split the sea, just so what? Just so the Mitzvah could follow them to the end? Wasn't it clear to them at this point, oh, we see what's happening. So therefore, Tosfos says, actually, they were confused for a different reason. Tosfos, we assume that what happened was the people just walked through the Yam Suf, they kept on going, until they got to the other end. That's not what happened. He says the Yam Suf opened and then formed a semicircle coming back. So they were basically forced to go into the water, and then they were just going to come right back out of the water. And they were concerned that the Mitzrayim would not follow them in, that they would be waiting on the other end to catch them, and then they would be stuck on all ends. That was their concern. Tosfos actually draws a picture. This version over here on the right is actually somewhat of a doctored version, but this is basically what Tosfos show. And here's another version that's written in Sefer Avri Nachal. Basically, they leave Mitzrayim over here, they go into the Yam Suf, and they come right back out of the Yam Suf. Here's another illustration. This is, according to the Medrash, tells us that there were different lanes, right? 12, one lane for each Shevet. So basically they walk, they go a semicircle, and they come right back out. They don't actually cross all the way through the Yam Suf. Tosfos says this explains something else. Later on in Sefer Bamidbar, the teller tells us all the different stops that the people made in the desert, and it tells us that they come to Marah, right? So they leave Mitzrayim over here, they go to the Yam Suf, they come to the Marah, and then afterwards it says they go to the Yam Suf. So Tosfos says, why are they going to the Yam Suf for? Why did they turn around? They came from the Yam Suf. So Tosfos says, no, didn't you see what happened? When they left Mitzrayim, they came in the Yam Suf, and then they came out of the Yam Suf again. And they were still in this area of the Yam Suf. Marah's right there, and that shows you the whole journey all the way to Eretz Yisrael. So, fascinating story, whoever knew. The fact is that when crossing the Yam Suf, Bnei Yisrael did not necessarily emerge on the other side of the sea. I say not necessarily, because this is one approach to answering these questions, but a fascinating one, one that seems to, you know, to have a very strong basis. More importantly, there doesn't seem to be any reason necessarily to reject this. So it just shows that we have ways that we imagine things. I get that's what a myth is. We have certain ways of thinking the way this is what it must have looked like going back to those pictures. Now, if you try to draw pictures of that, they may not necessarily be quite as exciting. So what was the big miracle of the Yam Suf? What was really quite amazing? Mitzvah behind them, the Yam Suf in front of them, they walk into the Yam Suf, the Mitzvah follow. That's a miracle right there that they followed. And then they drown. They all get stuck and the Jews leave, and it was a nice way to save the Jews. Okay, myth. The Luchos had round tops, rounded tops. This is a big one, right? These are all nice pictures of what the Luchos may have looked like, right? You've seen all these. Actually, the only picture I could find online of rectangular tablets was this one over here. This is, yeah. I can't get credit for that. I just copied it. But somebody very clever thought of that. But anyway, all kidding aside, if we take that out, you've all seen pictures like this, and there are many others. This is how we all imagine the tablets, right? Just like that. Do we have one? No, we don't have one here. But they're all over. They're all over. Rounded tablets. Says the Gemara in Bava Batra, Daf Yudalid. Aron, the Aron in which the tablets were placed, Sha'asa Moshe, Amasayim v'chetzi arko, v'ama v'chetzi rachbo, v'ama v'chetzi kamoso. 2.5 amos wide, 2.5 amos long, and an am and a half in height. And ba'ama bas shisha tfachim, assuming that the ama was 6 tfachim, that's the measure we're using. V'haluchos, orchon shisha, v'rachman shisha, v'avyon shlosha, menachos keneged orcho shel aron. So the luchos fit perfectly in the Aron. There are two different opinions, the Gemara Bava Basra, according to Rabbi Yehuda Meir, as to how exactly they fit, and in fact the Torah scroll was placed next to it, or perhaps not. Two different opinions. There's a beautiful publication, it just came out a few years ago. I recommend it, it's very nice. It's published by Art School. It's called the Mishkan, I believe that's what it's called, the Kleiman edition. Some very, very beautiful, really breathtaking illustrations of all the clay of Mishkan. So this actually doesn't do it justice, and I'm glad it doesn't, because, you know, I would have felt bad just going ahead and just, which I did, I just took a picture straight out of the book. But it shows
you know, they're actually supposed to look almost blue, which is, it would seem that that's what the color of the luchos were, sapphire blue. Those are two different luchos. And they fit right there in the box. Again, two different opinions as according to Reb Meir and Reb Yehuda, what exactly it looked like. Another really fascinating illustration that I found online as to what the luchos may have looked like, assuming that sort of this sapphire blue, which had, again, the as Chazal tell us, the words engraved from one side to the other, miraculously almost suspended, as certain letters require some sort of miraculous suspension, the way that's described over here. This may have been what the luchos looked like, but they were not round. They were not round. Now, I'm sure people knew this for a very long time, but it was the Lubavitch Rebbe Zichrono Livracha who made a very, very big deal about this. And he tried to make this, I'm sure not the biggest agenda, but make this a big agenda that people should go ahead and stop buying into this fallacy. And in a big sicha, a big drasha from Brengen that he gave on Parshas Kisisa, which is this week's Parsha, in the year 5741, so what's that, about 35 years ago, 36 years ago? So this is the actual Yiddish transcription of this section. Took me a little while to find it online, but I did. And thank you to Gitto Viswanath. I have an actual translation over here as well. I was able to more or less figure it out, but I didn't want to trust my own translation of Yiddish. Says the Rebbe, the simple and true reason why Jews see the image of the tablets as semicircular on top is because when they used to give a sefer for printing, they mostly gave it to a non-Jew. And because of a royal decree, it also had to go through a censor, and mostly it was a non-Jewish censor. So they, the non-Jewish printers and censors, would put on the cover and other available space at the beginning of the book an image of the tablets in a way that it appears to them. That is, that the tablets were semicircular on top in the manner that non-Jews render the image of the tablets. And when the Sefer got to the Jews, they didn't look, and they weren't strict regarding what was located on the cover and what it said in the rabbinical recommendations, askamos. Rather, they just looked what was inside. Therefore, they didn't pay attention to the fact that the tablets were semicircular on top. And so it went from generation to generation. It became a normal thing that in Jewish books you see images of the tablets being semicircular on top. Really actually very similar to the apple that we spoke about earlier, which may actually just be because of Christian influence. Now, these are all logos of different Chabad organizations, Sichos Lenoar, Merkaz Le'inyon Echinuch, and you'll note, Lishitasam, like the Rebbe asked them to, look at that, very interesting. All of the pictures of the Luchos are square. There is actually a publication, an entire book that is written by a Lubavitcher Rav in Eretz Yisrael, and it's called Al-Chet Ha-Eagle. I'll give you a second if you didn't get that yet. Al-Chet, regarding the chet, not of the eagle, but of the eagle, which means making a circle. And his entire kuntras written on this topic about how this happened. Some people are very passionate about this. Other people, they may not care much, because after all, what's the big deal? But, you know, after all, if you want to, it's an explicit chazal. It's not that there are two opinions about this, so we should get it right. Now, the chief rabbinate of Israel has as part of its logo, Luchos. Now, you see, this is a letter from 2002, 2011, 2013. This was the logo of the Rabbanut of Israel for I don't know how many years, but probably several decades, maybe since the beginning of the Rabbanut. Until 2 years ago, Rav David Lau changed it. And this, I believe, is a Chabad publication where they talk about the fact that it's been changed. That's what the old logo used to look like, and that's the new one. And if you got a letter today from the Chief Rabbi of Israel, it's going to have right there on top the rectangle luchos. So this is an evolving topic. This is really changing as we speak. The Chief Rabbin of Israel just decided to sort of get with the program and say, you know, it's not right. You know, why should we continue to go ahead and promulgate this myth? It's not true. Okay, very interesting. So the fact is the luchos were not rounded at the top. A myth. If Rabbeinu Tam were alive today, he would wear a pair of Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. That's interesting. Well, why wouldn't he, right? Now, what's the story of Rabbeinu Tam? So there are four places in the Torah where the Torah talks about the mitzvah of tefillin. Right? Two of them are found in Parshas Bo, one in Parshas Veschanan, and one in Parshas Ve'ekev. Those excerpts are all found over there. We're all familiar with the basic text, even though it varies a little bit. Shatam la'osa yodecha, v'ayulot tafos beninecha, different forms of that idea. So the Torah tells us in four places, one is to wear tefillin, and we know that in the tefillin sheyad, in the box that one wears on the hand, so the four parshios are actually written on one cloth, rolled up and stuck inside. There's one compartment. In Tefillin Shel Rosh, there are actually four separate compartments, and these four parshiyos are written on four different klafim. So the machlokas, but famous machlokas between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi and his grandson, were regarding the order of the parshiyos. The Gemara Menachos tells us the order, but it's not so clear whether it first goes, according to Rashi, basically starting, if you're facing the one wearing tefillin, starting from the right and moving over to the left, and the order found in the Torah, Kadesh v'hayik v'yachas shmaisa v'hayim shemola. According to Rabbeinu Tam, so the last two parshiyos are flipped, as you can see over there. So that's the basic machlokas. We're not going to discuss right now, but this is fascinating. I'm sure it must be bothering some of you if you've never thought about this before. How did it come to this? And it was tefillin had been around forever, so to speak. So why did it take until Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam to have this debate? So the simple answer to that question is it didn't take until them. It was an old debate and went back for a long time. And why couldn't they just check the first pair of tefillin? So there's been a lot discussed and a lot written on this topic. It's a fascinating one. There are other examples of halachos in which there seem to be such variant views, and the question is, how did this happen? How could there be such, you know, why is karpa celery in your home and parsley in my home? That's not such a pella. That makes perfect sense, because they're similar enough, and not everybody had celery, not everybody parsley, and some people have bananas, and I think I may have mentioned a couple weeks ago, somebody I knew even has an egg. Okay, we can understand that, but tefillin, really? So that's a discussion for another time, but let's accept for a moment, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam argue. Now, in the Tshuvas Noda Behuda, Rabbi Chezkel Landau, so he's responding to a letter that he received over here. And he says, you know, you wanted to know, somebody was asking him, why is it that the medaktikim, certain people who are medaktik, who are very particular to wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin also, I don't think there are people today only wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, but there are people who wear Rashi tefillin, and then they put on another pair of Rabbeinu Tam tefillin in order to satisfy that opinion. So why are they only concerned about that particular sheet of Rabbeinu Tam? There's another sheet of Rabbeinu Tam, that very same Rabbeinu Tam also held that the parshiyos are not inserted vertically, but rather horizontally. They lie down. And this is fascinating. This is a Tosfos in Maseches Menachos. Tosfos tells us when the Sifrei Torah are placed in the Aron, they should be lying down, bringing us back to one of the last myths, just like the Aron like the Luchos in the Aron were lying flat. That's the more respectful way, not having them standing up. The same thing in Parshiyos Tefillin, it says the same thing by Mezuzah. Rabbeinu Tam says the Mezuzah should be horizontal, Rashi says vertical, and many know. How do we do it? We do it, which that's maybe one of the only situations that I know of where we sort of compromise in such a way. Fascinating. Somebody said to me a couple weeks ago, why didn't you make that one of the myths? And you know what my answer was? It's not a myth. It's true. It's actually true. We actually do it as on an angle. To try to satisfy both opinions. So which way is the mezuzah supposed to be facing? But Tosfos says over here that Rabbeinu Tam says that the parshiyos should be horizontal in the bottom, not vertical, the way we've always seen it. So the Shoel asked Ben Oda Behuda, why is it that the people wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin only wear it that way? So Ben Oda Behuda suggests, he says, to me it's not such a pella. He says, because Rabbeinu Tam's opinion about the order of the parshiyos, that's not just Rabbeinu Tam's opinion. That was also the opinion of Haigon, Rav Yosef Tevelim. It quotes other Gaonim as well, who also had that opinion. So therefore, there's a very significant minority, to be a very significant one over here, that says that the order of the parshiyos is like we say Rabbeinu Tam. This idea that the parshiyos should actually be horizontal, not vertical, so that's only Rabbeinu Tam, and there would be no reason to go ahead and create a pair of tefillin just to satisfy that Das Yochid, so says the Noda Behuda. Now, this is very interesting. In the Sefer Hagioni Halacha, Rav Mirsky, so he says something very interesting. He said, quotes from the Vilna Gaon, that if he would go ahead and create a pair of tefillin to satisfy all the different opinions in the Rishonim, you want to take a guess how many pairs of tefillin he would need? What does it say? 64. 64 pair of tefillin in order to satisfy all the different shitos. So therefore, the Vilna Gaon was not interested in wearing a Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. And he quotes as well from Rabbi Yisrael Mishakalov, who heard from the Gra, that when he gets to the Olam Emes, he has a lot of questions for Rabbeinu Tam that he intends to ask him. But Rav Mirsky quotes an amazing, sort of beautiful, beautiful story over here that his Rebbe, Rabbi Chezkel Sarno, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chevron Yeshiva at the end of his life, and it says over here that Rabbi Chezkel Sarno used to wear tefillin all day long, and he did not wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. And towards the end of his life, he started to wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin very, very, very close to the end of the day. So Rav Mirsky says over here, students asked him, Rebbe, what's going on? Why did you change? So he said, in his opinion, Rabbeinu Tam is incorrect.
Unlike the Vilna Gaon, he intends to ask him questions when he gets to the next world. But as he was getting older and he realized he was getting closer to meeting Rabbeinu Tam, he was concerned that if he wouldn't wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, he wouldn't deserve a conversation with him. Rabbeinu Tam says, I'm gonna talk to you about my tefillin. You didn't even wear my tefillin. So he wanted to start wearing Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. But what about Rashi's tefillin? After all, he wore Rashi's tefillin all day. How could he take them off? So you know what he started to take off Rashi's tefillin at the point of Shkia. Shkia sunset, which we mark here as the point, let's say the latest point, you can say Mincha. So according to Rashi, that's the end of the day. However, you all know that according to Rabbeinu Tam, that's not the end of the day yet. So he came up with a schap. When Rashi said the day was over, he took off his tefillin. And now, as far as Rashi is concerned, it's no longer the daytime. I don't wear tefillin. But Rabbeinu Tam, who says, no, daytime continues now for another, whatever, a half hour, 40 minutes. So he put on Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin so he could prepare to meet him in the Olam Emes. It's so beautiful. On so many levels, I just find that to be so incredible. So the fact is that if Rabbeinu Tam were alive today, he would probably not wear a pair of Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin the way we have it. He would probably make his own special pair that had the parshios horizontally the way he liked them. Myth: Rashi's daughters wear tefillin. That's right, we've all heard this myth, I think so, about Rashi's daughters wearing tefillin. Rashi, famous commentator, famous Rav, famous leader during one of the very dark periods of European history, lived in France, as you see from 1040 to 1106, and he had four daughters. He didn't have any sons. Rashi's oldest daughter, Yocheved, married Rav Meir ben Shmuel. They had four sons, Yitzchak, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, who's known as Rivam, Rav Shmuel, known as Rashbam, Shlomo, and Yaakov, known as Rabbeinu Tam, who we just quoted beforehand, was his youngest grandson from his daughter Yocheved. He had a daughter Miriam, who married Rav Yehuda ben Natan, known as the Rav Rivan. He had a daughter Rachel, and another daughter who died young, and there doesn't seem to be any documentation of her name. So these were Rashi's daughters, very distinguished, as you could tell, as they had very distinguished families. Now, some of the sources, I'm not going to say the earliest one, that claim that Rashi's daughter would fill in Life on the Fringes, A Feminist Journey Towards Traditional Rabbinic Ordination, or Journal of Jewish Music and Liturgy, all published relatively recently. So Rabbi Dr. Ari Zavatovsky, who we quoted recently, about this topic said, regarding Rashi's daughters, one can argue that absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. However, because the notion of Rashi's daughters wearing tefillin appears only in late 20th century writings, I haven't researched this thoroughly, but I'm assuming he has to make such a claim, does not seem to appear anywhere before that. This would indicate that it is in fact a myth. Now, Dr. Eliza Berger, in a book, Rapt Attention, May Women Wear Tefillin, this is actually an article which is found in another book, Jewish Legal Writings by Women, she writes, there is no proof of the popular legend that Rashi's daughters wear tefillin. However, it is interesting to speculate on why this association arose. And it probably has to do with the fact that Rashi's daughters were known to be exceptional in that they were educated. And as we know, and that's not a myth at all, until relatively recently in history, Jewish women were not educated. Women were not educated. Jewish women additionally were not educated, other than whatever they received in the home. Rashi, we have a very strong tradition that his daughters were educated. They used to learn with them. I think many said that he actually learned Gemara with them. And it therefore is not surprising that you would find, you know, the evolution of such a myth. Again, we're calling it a myth because it doesn't seem to be any, other than, again, relatively recent in history, it doesn't seem to be any documentation that would indicate that Rashi's daughters wore tefillin. The fact of the matter is that there is no evidence that Rashi's daughters wore tefillin. And the final myth of the evening is that the Purim story spans several months. Now, this is fresh in our minds, so this is a good myth to talk about right now. Just yesterday and the night before, we read the Megillah story. It's a very dramatic story. It's one that intrigues us each and every year. Several years ago, I was introduced to a new book. Actually, it was only published several years ago. So we were all introduced to a book by Rabbi Foreman called The Queen You Thought You Knew. I gave several shiurim, not this year, but in the past, based on his writings. And I know many people found them to be incredibly invigorating. They were just so amazing. And I remember the shiur I gave last year, people actually crying at the end. I'm not exaggerating. Not because of my delivery, but because of his Torah. And what was so refreshing and so transformational was the fact that we were able to go ahead and sort of rediscover and learn and understand in a deeper way the story that we all thought we knew. But part of the story of Purim, the way we read it, and part of, I think, what makes it so intriguing and what makes it so easy is for us to connect to it in an emotional way, is the fact that we're viewing it as if it's happening as quick as we're reading it. Now, if you were with me in the first meeting on Sunday morning, so you know that that was about 15 or 16 minutes. If you were one of the later minyanim, so maybe it was 35 minutes. But within the span of 15 to 35 minutes, that's it. That's the whole story. Now, of course, we know the story took long. How long did it actually take? Well, so here's an actual timeline. In the year 3395, which is about 2,400 years ago, Achashverus makes a feast for all 180 nations. As we know, the feast lasts for 7 days, and the last day he calls Vashti. She refuses to come, and she's killed. 4 years later, Esther is crowned as his queen. 5 years after that, there is a gezeirah of Haman to go ahead and to destroy the Jews. 3 days later, there is a fast that is declared, a three-day fast. And 1 day after that, the king can't sleep, and he has this whole, you know, idea to go ahead and to read the chronicles, and he discovers that what? It turns out that Mordechai was never rewarded. That was when? That was Tezai Nisan. The next day, that was in the night. So the next day, Haman is basically brought to the streets, and then on the second day after that, there's the big feast, and Haman is hanged. Approximately a year later, because that was on Pesach, that was on Tezai Nisan, approximately a year later, what we call today Tanis Esther, Yud Gimel Adar, the Jews are facing doom and defend themselves. On the 14th of Adar, 1 day later, the Jews are successful in saving themselves and continue to kill some of their enemies. Then we have what's called Shushan Purim. 1 year later, Mordechai and Esther make a formal request to the Sanhedrin to go ahead and to establish a day known to us as Purim. And 2 years after that, Dayavish goes ahead and he gives the orders to go ahead and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. So the entire timeline from beginning to end is, according to this, it's 11 years. Yeah, that's 11 years. So that's a long time. I think this is important because, like I said, one of the reasons why I think many of us, it's not just us, you read a lot about this, especially, it's not new to this year, but people always finding parallels in whatever is going on in the day, particularly in terms of politics, to what was going on then. Because we're always able to do that. And we find a certain amount of comfort and excitement in doing that. Achashverosh is like this one, and Haman's like this one, and Esther's like this one, and all the characters seem to find their place. And one of the reasons I think we do that is because we try to make sense out of things that just don't make sense, and we're trying to find order in the hefkeiros of history as it's unfolding. And it's sometimes very frustrating. And we take some comfort in knowing, well, this fits into a great divine plan, which of course it does, and everything has its time and place, and just like the Purim story, like, Hu d'maaseh orah v'simcha v'sasa mikar, kein tihyeh lanu, the same will be for us, and we just have to wait. But that's the point, we just have to wait. And sometimes we think we just have to wait another couple of weeks, another couple of months, because that's all it was then, and the answer is no, it was actually 10 years, maybe more. So it was a long story. Now, over the course of Jewish history, 10 years is not a long time, right? We've been talking about parallels to the Persian Empire for many, many centuries, millennia, in fact. That's true, but at any given moment, you know, it's easy for us to sort of get caught up in all that and feel a sense of excitement that we're part of, you know, some unfolding hand of history, which again, we are, but we have to remember to have patience. We have to remember that even the most dramatic stories in Tanakh, the ones that just everything seems to come together in such a beautiful way, and it's all beautiful, and it's amazing. Kimu v'kiblu, and you find God's hand in his, it's all true. But remember that story took 10 years. And from the time that Achashverosh killed Vashti, it was not 5 years until Esther replaced Vashti. And then it was another 5 years before what? Before Gezeirus Haman. And then things picked up pretty quickly, and then they slowed down again. And, you know, it didn't necessarily fit the tempo that the Baal Koreh suggests when reading the Megillah. And, you know, we should get chizuk from that. We shouldn't be depressed when we're hearing that. We should just remind ourselves that even though things don't always, you know, play out the way we would sort of expect them to in a nice, neat, packaged way, we just have to have more patience with the Yad Hashem. Oh, I guess it's appropriate that I have to mess up my last slide. It's not a myth. The fact is that the Purim story spans 10 years. That is the fact.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful learning with you.